made it all the way here, I might as well give you the show. So, to introduce today's sermon, I've got a little proverb attributed to the Taoist religious leader Lao Tzu. The wise person is the one who knows that they do not know. The wise person is the one who knows that they do not know. So I own something that's just a little bit peculiar for a Unitarian Universalist minister to own. It's not like scandalous or inappropriate, like owning Nazi memorabilia or something like that. It's just kind of unusual and untraditional for a minister like me. It's like finding a pear on a Jewish Passover Seder plate. It's not unkosher and it's not bad, but people are going to wonder, how did that get there and what is it going to be used for? Because that isn't where we anticipate finding such a thing. So I brought my unusual object with me this morning and want to show it to you. It is an icon of St. Thomas. And way back when I was in seminary and dating Jason, the guy who would become my husband, who, by the way, is a very, very devout Episcopalian. He's a lay minister in the Episcopal Church. He bought this for me as a gift from an Eastern Orthodox gift shop in Indianapolis. Now, obviously, at that point, Jason didn't understand much about Unitarian Universalism, but he did know me. And he was actually more right than I really understood at the time. By tradition, just to explain the icon, Thomas is usually portrayed as a beardless teenager holding a scroll that symbolizes wisdom. And this image hangs out on a wall above my desk in my office at home, where I most frequently prepare sermons for spoken ministry, and I'm going to rest him right here. So St. Thomas is a figure that is often held in a certain level of contempt, especially in Protestant and conservative Christian circles. According to tradition, on one of the Sundays after Easter, the congregation is supposed to hear the story of the doubting Thomas. And so a good number of preachers parade out Thomas, hear his doubts about the resurrection of Jesus, and in many places in America, the preacher then tells people to feel guilty about their doubts because it supposedly is a virtue to think that something is true without any evidence that it actually is true. But, friends and neighbors, no matter if we admit it or not, we all have doubts. And I think that doubts can be put to good use. And fortunately, in the biblical story, Thomas was very honest about what he questioned, what he truly doubted. With the story of Thomas, if we delve deeper, we can come to understand something that's actually kind of amazing. Something about the nature, limitations, and usefulness of doubt. Something about the process that brings about deeper religious conviction, and something about the spiritual power of compassion as well. Now, as I said earlier, doubt is something most people don't spend time reflecting on. In the West, from the 1800s forward, the word doubt took a tone of disloyalty. Often, doubt was juxtaposed with belief, as if these two things are mere opposites, doubt versus belief. Where belief, oversimplified again, is the assertion that something is true and preferably asserted as true without any evidence at all. Now, it fascinates me that there are older versions of Christianity where this binary is not strictly held true. For example, in the ancient world, the Hebrew and Greek terms translated into English as faith were not strongly associated with saying that something was true. There's a nuance that gets missed. To have faith in the ancient world was a loyalty statement. If one had faith in somebody, one was loyal to them. And that's where we get the term fidelity when it comes to marriage or even a business contract. In a parallel manner, to believe in Jesus had less to do with specific thinking about certain notions about what was true about Jesus. Believing in Jesus was more like saying to a friend, "I believe in you. I believe in you. In other words, I support you, I encourage you, and I think you are going to succeed." Doubt was not disloyalty. Disloyalty would instead have been termed as faithlessness. I cheat on you, I discourage you, I do not support you, and I don't think you're going to succeed. And all those statements are faithless, at least by ancient standards. So doubt was not really the opposite of belief, or at least not cleanly the opposite of belief, and instead, doubt was the difficult and sometimes even painful thing that preceded both faith, loyalty, and belief. I believe in you. Later philosophers like Descartes put it this way: doubt is the touchstone of truth. Who's familiar with what a touchstone really is? A little bit of my background. I was a geologist before I went to seminary. So, a touchstone is a very long-standing tool used by ancients, mostly merchants, and by modern geologists alike. It is a piece of jasper, sometimes chalcedony, used to test for the presence of gold or silver by looking at the color of the mark the metal left behind on the touchstone. You take your little rock and you try to streak it. If the metal leaves a yellow streak, it is gold. And if the streak is gray, it is silver. But if it is green or brown, it is neither of those. It is most likely pyrite, which is not good for making jewelry. In the same manner, doubt is a tool for testing. And testing leads to truth. In our story this morning, the body of Jesus leaves a mark on Thomas's touchstone of doubt. And so we arrive at the story where Thomas expresses his doubts that Jesus is somehow alive and walking around after being crucified. Remember that in the Eastern and Catholic churches, Thomas has always been termed a saint. While among a certain stripe of conservative Protestant, he's mostly been presented as a failure. I'm going to give you the short paraphrase of the journey because who wants a very long Bible reading? So be this story history or legend or allegory or some really perplexing and fun combination of all three, Simon Peter and Mary Magdalene journey to the tomb and found it empty and did not understand what happened. Now, there's also a story that Mary Magdalene encountered Jesus in the garden outside the tomb, but she was so grief-stricken she couldn't really recognize him until he Then there's also a story about the disciples inside a barricaded room where Jesus just walks in and says, "Peace be with you." He asks the disciples to examine the wounds on his hands. Then in his story, he says, "As the Father has sent me, so I am sending you." Thomas wasn't there. He was not in the room to talk with anybody or even to examine the wounds in the story, no matter if you think the story is history or legend or allegory. So imagine Thomas's state of mind. Skeptical because the dead do not just get up and walk back to the dinner table. Likely Thomas was anxious and afraid. I would have been. How would you feel if somebody here... was apparently murdered later this week, you even went to the funeral, and then you were told a week later that they showed back up here. We shook hands, we talked a while, had coffee. Like Thomas, you'd be skeptical, at the least, and likely a little emotionally upset. I would be. In the story, 8 days later, Thomas walks into another room with the disciples and again walks in saying, "Peace be with you." And what happened next? Well, Thomas was not condemned. Did Jesus walking into the room denounce him as some kind of sin-filled skeptic? Did Jesus shame and humiliate Thomas in front of the whole community? No. In the story, be it history or legend or allegory, Jesus did the same thing he did earlier with all the other people. He told Thomas to examine his wounds on his hands. And rather compassionately, Jesus gave Thomas the evidence Thomas needed, the same evidence he gave everybody else the week before. Stone of Thomas's own hands and mind. And I hear the next five words in the story, not in a scolding tone, it gets read to people in a scolding tone, but spoken in a tone of just like great hope. And do not be unbelieving. In other words, I really, really hope you recognize me. Do you recognize me? Do you see who I am? It's really me. Whatever happened, I'm not dead. See the marks that point to understanding. Doubt leads to discovery. Revelation, even, if you want to use that term, that transforms. Those powerful people who tortured and murdered didn't get away with it. I want you to remember that often our deepest convictions about religion grow out of the open soil of doubt. Doubt leads to testing. Testing points to things that are true. As the process worked for St. Thomas, it could also work for you, no matter if you think you're someone who follows Jesus or not. Doubt works on every spiritual path. And every single person here has doubts, even if we do not always admit them. Doubt is the question that is searching for an answer. An answer that, when discovered, we each can embrace with our whole hearts and minds, because we've done the hard work of testing. Now, there are limitations to doubt. Doubt is meaningless without our willingness to search. If we simply sit with doubts and anxiety, we remain unbelieving in a way regarding all manner of things. We become a question mark that refuses to go forth and search for an answer. And a question that refuses to seek an answer can be a sad thing indeed. Sometimes, in Unitarian Universalist churches, we can be a little vulnerable to this. I have done this myself, and I've seen other people do it. Well, I don't think that, and I don't think that, and I'm pretty sure that's not true, and I don't think that. But am I able to say what my convictions really are? Am I able to say the things that I think are true? That we all deserve to be treated with worth and dignity? That reason is one of the most amazing gifts given to the human being, all of us. That the search for truth is a lifelong process. You don't just get to find a little chunk of truth and say, "Wee, I'm saved, done, once and done." The question needs to seek an answer. The Unitarian preacher and poet Robert Weston said this very, very well. "Those that would silence doubt are filled with fear. Their houses are built on shifting sand, but those who fear not doubt and know its use are founded on the rock. They shall walk in the light of growing knowledge. The work of their hands shall endure. Therefore, let us not fear doubt. Let us rejoice in its help. It is to the wise as a staff is to the blind. Doubt is the attendant of truth." I'm looking at the clock. I'm aware that I'm somewhat a succinct preacher. Which can be a good thing at times. At the little congregation I serve in a little rural farm town in Ohio, if you can imagine, a UU church that's been a little farm town since 1849. Yep, just keeps chugging along. We only have 17 people, but you know, that's, but we'll probably outlast the Methodists. Rumor has it they're slated to close. We usually do a little dialogue time. Maybe this is working, maybe it's not. Test.
You don't have to hold it down because it's on and connected.
Test.
You don't hold it long, hold it down longer until.
Yeah. Green light.
Yay.
Test. So it's always fun when the message is not completely mine, that it also includes people in the congregation. If you could be my time minder.
Oh, I'm not good at that at all.
I guide the time minder if you tell me what to look for.
Where's the clock?
Give it 10 minutes.
All right. We'll give 10 minutes.
Eventually,
try that.
My car restarts.
Okay.
What is stirring in your hearts and minds this morning? Or even questions you have. I may not have the answer. But...
They'll start talking. They just need to think. Because you use think and then they talk.
So. I have one person named Dee who is always good for getting things rolling. there's someone behind
there
you.
There we go.
Are there two?
Learn to forgive more.
Learn to forgive more.
There's someone behind you.
Yeah.
Well, the doubt, the thing that comes to my mind about doubt is that I shouldn't be bringing up politics, but the people that are willing to believe something that is so unproven in life today are so utterly crazy. It's hard to take those people seriously at all. In my,
I will share. So this is a struggle that I have been
So this is a struggle I've been personally dealing with. I have a brother who I love, love, love dearly, who is very educated, a very ethically principled person. At some point during the pandemic, he went anti-vaccine. But he says, well, I read all this stuff on Facebook. When our environments are filled with untruths, it becomes really, really, really hard for even decent people to sort it out. My mother, having had a medical career as an occupational therapist, keeps gently pushing against him, going, gosh, like all these people have gotten vaccinated and they're doing okay. Isn't the chance of something bad happening bigger if you don't? Well, Mom, you don't know what's going to happen long term. Well, I'm going to get vaccinated. Your brother got vaccinated. You might want to think about it. It's hard to take seriously, but I have to take my own sibling seriously, even if I think he has been flooded with misinformation. And I wish he had showed a little skepticism, like, so who are these people I'm reading online? Where are they getting their information? Why should I think they're true when medical professionals, including my own doctor, are telling me, you might want to get vaccinated?
Well, unfortunately, they are medical professionals who don't believe in vaccinations.
You can find professionals that will tell you, like, so I'm a geologist, but if you look around hard enough somewhere, like literally under a rock, you will find some oddball who wants to refute, a geologist who wants to refute geological time and say, oh, the world's only 6,000 years old. It makes it so much harder for us. Part of what I did as a scientist is you have to think. So all this information gets peer-reviewed, sort of crowdsourced. Now, the crowd can get things wrong every now and then. There is the problem of groupthink. But scientists are always prodding at the information to see if somebody's got it wrong, because the path to scientific success is finding out the paradigm was wrong. And going, oh, the groupthink got it wrong. Like, for example, Alfred Wegener created the theory of plate tectonics. But until we had sonar maps of the bottom of the ocean, people thought he was full of bunk. Continents can't move around, they're too big. Maybe things go up and down. But when they found C4 spreading, it was like, oh, yeah, Wegener was right. This is really hard because people want to hold things with certainty, absolute certainty, and not go through the hard work, whether it's science or medicine or religion, of constantly just checking, checking, checking. Have I got this right? Is there something new I need to learn?
Yes.
Before I get off my soapbox. There was a Universalist minister, this was obviously far before the merger, named Michael Wolfhart, who was asked by an elderly Benjamin Franklin, why does your faith community never publish a statement of faith? Michael Wolfhart replied, we are unsure that we have arrived at the end of this progression. And we are concerned that if we issue a statement of faith that is supposed to be true now and forever, we will render ourselves unable to receive improvement from God. Franklin's reply was, I have never heard a statement of that kind of humility from any religious group.
The whole question of doubting, you might see if your brother can find an ICU nurse from the local hospital and ask her how many patients does she have who haven't had a vaccine. That might help convince him. But there's a meme going around on...
I've tried the same thing. I've told them, you realize, Matt, like down here in Richmond at Reed, like 90% of the people who are hospitalized with COVID never got vaccinated.
Yep.
And the other 10% are just very frail.
Mm-hmm. There's a meme going around that says, we have 500 scientists who have signed a proclamation saying that climate change is not real. So I went, they had them listed and their degrees and everything. So I went and started going down through them. I went about halfway through and I found two people who might have been climate scientists. Everybody else, their science was something else.
That is another thing to be ever, ever, ever on the watch for. There was a similar thing, I don't remember which state it was in, somebody came forward to be an expert witness on issues of gender-affirming care for children. Was this person a pediatrician? I'm a medical doctor. Was this person a pediatrician? No. Were they an endocrinologist? No. Radiologist.
That's
radiologist.
I do have a question, though. How do you see reason versus rationality?
Yeah. Reason. Some of the difficulty is we want like big categories. Reasoning is a tool that we use. You're probably thinking about sort of people rationalizing things, maybe. Reason, like any tool, whether it's a hammer or a wrench, can be misapplied. I can try to use a hammer to beat a screw into the wall. Not a great idea. I can try to use reason to try and prop up some kind of prejudice that I have. And people will work very, very, very hard to do that. How do we know when we're rationalizing? The horrible part is we don't always know we're doing it when we're doing it. And that's why it's good to have communities of close, trusted friends who can raise the yellow flag and say, you might want to think about that. Here's this information about ICU, or here is someone I'd like you to talk to. Reasoning is hard. It's one of the difficult things that humans do, but it's also one of the most important. But rationalizing, you know, that can take us to very painful places where you get obstinate in your position and you're just wanting to find a way to make it true. I've got a million stories for a million different things, but there is a parable that was created by I wish I could remember his name right now off the top of my head. He was a Jewish rabbi and a psychiatrist, and he used this story to talk to his psychiatry students about people rationalizing things. He calls it the parable of the dead man. A man came home from work and told his wife that work was so awful he died. And she's like, oh, he's exaggerating, blah, 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 blah. He had a really hard day. He's like, no, I'm literally dead. And she says, honey, you're not dead. You're walking around and breathing and talking to him. Yes, I'm dead. The neighbors come over and talk to him. They can't convince him that he's not dead. And then the local minister comes by and says, you realize you're talking. Like, dead people don't talk. Like, no, I died at work. It was such a bad day. I died at work. So eventually the doctor comes by and says, would you agree? If I do a little cut on your arm with a scalpel and you bleed, that would be an indicator you're actively bleeding, that you're alive. And if you don't, you know, your rigor mortis is setting in and you've died. And the guy says, yeah, let's give that a try. So the doctor does the cut and the guy's bleeding. And he says, now do you see that you're alive? And the man goes, oh, doctor, I'm so sorry. I was wrong. Dead men can bleed. It's, you know, that sticking to, like, trying to rationalize the thing that you want to be true.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking so much of rationalization as rationality as a tool versus reason. And I think, as Ursula K. Le Guin says that reason is a much larger thing than rationality.
Did you say Ursula Le Guin?
Ursula K. Le Guin, yeah.
Oh, yes, one of my favorites.
Oh, me too.
Yeah. Do you remember where she said it?
Pardon?
Do you remember where she's...
It was her Bryn Mawr, 1986 Bryn Mawr commencement address.
Oh, okay. Okay, I've never read that.
Oh, you need to. It's wonderful.
But I'm very fond of her fiction. I recommend it to everybody, yeah, even if you think you don't like science fiction or fantasy.
Yeah. Dancing at the Edge of the World is the book that it's from. And it's a collection of her nonfiction.
Anybody else? I think we have a few minutes.
Well, going back to the idea of rationalizing things, you know, I often ponder why that is. Why is it a matter of pride and not wanting to admit we were wrong, even if it causes our death? You know, even if we wind up in ICU because we didn't take the vaccine or whatever the circumstance may be, is it fear of maybe being judged by others, and it's easier just to persist in a certain line of thinking than to have to make reparations for things you did when you, you know, were having this fallacious thinking? Is it fear about what will happen in the world if we don't know all the answers to things? I mean, I've always lived my life as a fairly adventurous person and got to a place where I felt very comfortable taking a certain level of risk and thinking it through to a certain part, and then being okay with a certain level of uncertainty as well, and knowing that somehow, some way, I'll rise to the occasion, get through it, whatever, some way deal with whatever tends to come up. And it's been a wonderful life. And I look at other people who, you know, persist in this kind of thinking and having to have all the right answers and et cetera, and I'm thinking, I could just not ever live that life. That seems so static and so, I don't know, just, I don't want to use negative words like dull, but I mean, just like no opportunity for enlightenment or any of that. And I'm just thinking, why is it that there are so many people who really persist in wanting to live that way?
On the surface, it seems easy, but there's often points where it doesn't stay that way. Because eventually you encounter something that doesn't fit.
I just wanted to reply to those questions. Just my guess, my idea, and the people that I've known and what I've seen is I think a lot of people are reluctant to accept a loss. If you're wrong about something that you've invested in for years, like a religion or a relationship or any kind of beliefs or how you live your life, you have to take responsibility for that, and that's not great. Nobody, you know, some people just don't want to, or it's painful, they don't know how to handle it. As far as people, I've read about people who have ended up hospitalized and dying because they didn't want to get vaccinated. And they believe, even when they're in that position, they refuse to believe they were wrong. And looking at that, I could see where you wouldn't want to blame yourself for ending up that way. I think some people just don't feel like they're strong enough to take responsibility, I guess.
I have a comment to support. She's done. Worse. I'd like to mention to everybody that I'm very blessed because I help my tenant, it wasn't my tenant, it was roommate. She had COVID. and I felt it, and I wasn't afraid, because God blessed me with many, many immunities. My sister-in-law took 5 shots of COVID, and she's dying. And I'm not saying not to take the shot, by all means. If your immunities are not up, go get the shot. But if you feel that the Lord is in control and that you have high immunities, don't do it. That's all I gotta say.
I'm a little mindful of the time, and I'm not sure if my husband could be in Indianapolis, and I don't want to have him linger there too long in case I need a tow and extracted. So are we free to continue with the rest of the service?
Yes, we are.
As Quakers will sometimes ask, are all hearts and minds free? And people say yes.